Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. When it comes to successfully or unsuccessfully governing and managing communities, leadership decisions can make or break a city and or a region. St. Louis has been cited as a city that let greatness slip away over the 20th century. That's the contention of Professor Colin Gordon of the University of Iowa, as outlined in his 2008 book, Mapping Decline, St. Louis and the Fate of the American City. We're talking with him on today's program. Also with us is Professor Joel Rhodes of Southeast Missouri State University. He's the author of A Missouri Railroad Pioneer, The Life of Lewis Hauck. Both are history professors and will be here this weekend to participate in a discussion of how policy and spending decisions by business and government leaders have affected the growth, location, and vitality of Missouri communities. It's titled The Geography of Money. Professor Gordon joins us from Iowa City, Professor Rhodes from Cape Girardeau. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Don.
It's a pleasure.
Colin Gordon, let me begin with you. I think we need for me and perhaps for our audience a definition of geography of money. What does that mean?
It means, I think, the way in which spending decisions, the way in which spending both public and private resources in a metropolitan center setting affects the spatial distribution, the outcomes. In the St. Louis metropolitan region, we have a sort of famous case of dramatic central city decline and everything else, resources, people, infrastructure, tax capacity, spinning out to the suburbs.
And Joel Rhodes, the same definition applied to outstate Missouri.
I think a little bit. Our situation is different here in the Boot Heel because in the early 20th century, you had almost a logical transition from railroading to lumbering, which then led to drainage. Once Lewis Hauck and others opened up southeast Missouri to lumbering, some of the largest sawmills in the world were here at one time, and you can still, across the landscape of southeast Missouri, see the legacy of those. Many of the little towns here are sawmill towns. But once the swamps were completely denuded of timber, the large lumbering companies had thousands upon thousands of acres that were useless to them. And so the Little River Drainage District was started to drain the swamps and turn this into very profitable agricultural land.
And when was this happening precisely?
The railroads came to southeast Missouri in the 1870s and more importantly in the 1880s and 1890s. But by the early 20th century, by the 19-teens, most of the hardwood lumber, the cypress and the hickory and so forth, were pretty much gone. And the Little River Drainage District had been in the planning stages for a number of years in the early 20th century. But by the 19-teens and into the 1920s, it was under construction. And it's a very interesting story of a quasi-governmental company that assesses the landowners based on the projected benefit they're going to get from draining the entire region.
And Colin, a much different dynamic going on here at St. Louis at this particular time, a city that was really on the move, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think one way to contrast Joel's focus in mine is that, you know, one can think of investments in infrastructure, public and private investments, contributing to the development and the sort of economic trajectory of an era. I really pick up the story in St. Louis when that has played out and the city is more responding to its demise and trying to recapture what it once had. And the policies play out very differently in those two scenarios.
So it's really not possible to use the same yardstick in these two disparate areas.
Not exactly. I think maybe one of the common denominators we have in regard to social history is that once the Boot Heel is drained and the timber's obviously gone, then cotton comes in. The boll weevil infestation moves the cotton production north out of the Mississippi Delta. And with cotton production here also comes the sharecropping culture. So those types of drainage decisions and lumbering and railroad decisions had a huge impact on the community structure here and on the racial and social makeup of the region.
How about the utilization of both the geographic and infrastructure assets. I mean, obviously, this played into both areas very dramatically. In St. Louis, for instance, you know, we have the river, also railroads. But the railroad was something that really had to be developed about this time down in the Boot Heel.
Right, exactly. And Missouri's, their story of railroading is kind of, to borrow a phrase from the Grateful Dead, a long, strange trip with a relatively happy ending. But the state, through fits and starts, embarked on public funds for private railroading. But by the 1860s and 1870s, had abandoned that and, as a matter of fact, forbid the state and the counties and the municipalities from funding railroads by the 1870s.
And Colin, I know that you really pick it up in the latter half of the 20th century, but I think from a historical perspective, we ought to know what happened to St. Louis at the turn of this century, into the 20th century. I mean, we simply just sort of abdicated any superiority we might have enjoyed or thought we enjoyed to Chicago, didn't we?
Well, I think one way to look at it is that, you know, it's not a competition in a sense among cities in that they can all be winners. And I think if we look across the sort of landscape of urban history in the late 19th and early 20th century, we see the cities that are most troubled by the middle years of the 20th century are essentially river cities that don't capture, another or more diverse economic base. So St. Louis is in league with sort of Louisville and Buffalo and Cincinnati and cities like that that continue to rely on the river as their sort of major infrastructure.
But what is wrong with that? I mean, the river is certainly a busy place today.
Well, there's nothing wrong with it. In fact, it sustains St. Louis well into the 20th century. St. Louis, while it loses in the rail traffic to Chicago, it becomes a major trucking distribution center, and that waxes and wanes. But with the advent of containers, their movement up the Mississippi to depots like St. Louis, and then from there onto the highway system, was sort of very important infrastructural and economic advantage.
But, you know, you write of this community being one of decline, and yet you would think, looking at it, it's perfectly positioned for that not to happen, given the river and given the network of highways and roads that we have here. Given its position in the country, you would think that quite the opposite direction would have been taken.
Well, decline is a funny word to use in this context because, I mean, one can talk about, when we talk about urban decline, we're often talking about what happens to central cities in terms of racial segregation and concentrated poverty and deindustrialization, the sort of hollowing out of central cities. But it's often not the case, and this is true in St. Louis. The metropolitan region as a whole is not declining. It's just becoming thinner and sparser and more spread out, and its resources are elsewhere in the metropolitan region. They're flung to the suburban fringes. So St. Louis as a metropolitan area grows slowly, but it grows across the 20th century.
And Joel, looking at your neck of the woods, what is going on down there now? I mean, how would you describe the vitality, if that's the right word, vitality, growth, and potential of the Boot Heel right now?
Well, interestingly, this is certainly one of the most agriculturally productive regions of the state, if not the entire Midwest, but it's one of the poorest congressional districts in the country, believe it or not. So a lot of that is the lingering effects of that cotton culture that came with cotton production, almost a plantation and sharecropping mentality. And I think a lot of what still holds a good portion of the Boot Heel back from an economic development standpoint is that that long shadow of that agricultural system. And Cape Girardeau, where I'm at, has always been historically the center, the hub, the commercial hub, political, educational, entertainment, whatever. And so Cape Girardeau is semi-insulated from that. But if you go south towards the Arkansas border, this is the northern region of the reaches, I should say, of the Mississippi Delta. It's a very different culture down there.
Is there any way we can connect the dots between Cape Girardeau and St. Louis? I mean, economically and in terms of viability, if you will?
Well, I think Cape Girardeau would like that comparison. I mean, we pride ourselves and I think kind of position ourselves as the major metropolitan area between St. Louis and Memphis. But Cape Girardeau cast its lot very early with the railroads, much earlier than some Missouri communities. If you think about it, outside of Kansas City and St. Louis, the nine largest urban centers, if you will, in the state, most of them owe their 20th century configuration and prosperity to the railroads, whether or not it's Hannibal or Joplin or Springfield. But then Cape Girardeau was very active to get out in front of highway development in the 1920s. And so Cape has been very, very far-sighted in that regard. I think that that's continued into the 21st century.
And Colin, how do you see it with regard to any connectivity between these two regions or, you know, any region outside of this urban area in Missouri?
Well, I mean, I think the puzzle in some respects of the 21st century is the fact that our cities are still suffering. They're undergoverned. They're under-resourced. They're, the poor sort of stepsisters of American politics in terms of their claim on national attention. And yet at no time in our history have cities been more important economically. So, you know, the top 100 metro areas in this country occupy 12% of the land area, and they account for 80% of the gross national product. Mm-hmm. They're where almost all our good jobs are. They're where, most of our leading universities, leading research centers are. So I think the future is in metropolitan areas. And it's a shame that they continue to be governed in the way a city like St. Louis is governed.
Well, I want to pick up on that point with both of you gentlemen. When we come back, we have to take a break. My guests are Professor Colin Gordon of the University of Iowa. He is the author of the book written in 2008, Mapping Decline, St. Louis and the Fate of the American City. Professor Joel Rhodes of Southeast Missouri State University is joining us from Cape Girardeau. He is the author of the book, Missouri Railroad Pioneer, The Life of Lewis Hauck. By the way, Professors Gordon and Rhodes will be participating in a program titled The Geography of Money. That's happening at 2 p.m. on Saturday at the Missouri History Museum, hosted by the museum and the Missouri Humanities Council. Welcome back to continue our conversation, and we'd like to get you into it. What is your vision for this region? Are we on the right track? We'd like very much to hear from you at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can email us at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. We're also reachable through Facebook. Back with Professors Colin Gordon and Joel Rhodes, both history professors, in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Professors Colin Gordon of the University of Iowa and Professor Joel Rhodes of Southeast Missouri State University. We're taking a look essentially at what makes a community tick in terms of its economic vitality and growth. And we're focusing on St. Louis and the Cape Girardeau region and the applications, the lessons that have been learned there over the years, how they can be applied elsewhere. Colin, I'm particularly interested in the word that you used just before that break, and the word was undergoverned. What do you mean by that?
Well, in some respect, a city like St. Louis is overgoverned in the sense that the government structure is so fragmented, the decisions are being made in so many different places that it works against the best interests of the metropolitan area. But beneath that sort of veneer of fragmented governance, I think you have our metropolitan areas are don't receive their fair share of federal and state resources. They don't have the tax capacity they need to accomplish what it is that I think they should be accomplishing. And they don't have the political coherence to act in the best interests of the region as opposed to its constituent fragments.
Gee, I think a lot of people will listen to that and all of a sudden become fairly pessimistic about our future.
Sorry.
How about you, Joel? What do you read into that, and how does it apply to your area?
Well, I think it's, I'd hesitate to say maybe universal, but I think a lot of that resonates in even a smaller urban place like Cape Girardeau. Many of those problems are very applicable to Cape Girardeau.
How would you describe in a sentence or two the economic vitality of your area right now, Joel?
I think economically there is signs for optimism. There was a new casino, Isla Capri, has opened here in the last year, which certainly has created some jobs and a little bit of momentum. There is a revitalization of one of our major thoroughfares, Broadway, that's happening in conjunction with that. And there's been a lot of construction. I think there's been a noticeable uptick in construction here in the last couple of years. And so I don't know that the Cape is emerging quickly from the recession, but I think there's some pretty strong tailwinds at this point. And one of the things about Cape Girardeau, and again, a much smaller scale here than St. Louis, obviously, but there has been a very vital historic preservation element in Cape Girardeau, and part of that's been led by the university, but also there's a great deal of community involvement as well, interest in old buildings and adaptive reuse and creative uses for some of the older buildings. The Marquette Hotel is a great example of this. It's a 1920s Art Deco hotel that sat vacant for a number of years, but about 10 years ago was rehabilitated, and creatively the bottom level is a private business. It's a restaurant and bar, and then the top levels are state government offices. So that's been a real save, and it's kind of buttressed some of our more historic districts.
Colin, a lot of the things that Joel is mentioning there are really applicable here too. I mean, we've got a vibrant casino community, if you will, as many cities now do. Great universities. There is a resurgence in a great many of the neighborhoods. That kind of puts a positive spin on it, or does it?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I wouldn't mention casinos and universities in the same breath in terms of their impact on the
local
area.
Okay, I apologize for that.
But I do think, I mean, it does bring up an important point, because for a long time, the principal economic development strategy of St. Louis was to recapture some lost past, to bring retailers back downtown, to put up another baseball stadium, to bring in tourists, that sort of thing. And I think, to its credit, the city drifted away from that focus somewhat and started to recognize that that the returns on investing or building upon its substantial assets, and those would be hospitals, healthcare, universities, the riverfront. And, you know, unfortunately, that shift in policy comes in the 1970s, shift in local policy comes in the 1970s, just at the moment when federal money for doing big scale projects is disappearing. But I think there is a better recognition in the city and in the metropolitan region now of what its true assets are.
Yeah, and I think in Cape Girardeau, we're a little bit behind the curve there, because for most of the 20th century, Cape Girardeau made every effort to get away from the river. I mean, we've been tied to the river for so long, our very existence depends on it. But for most of the early 20th century, we kind of cast our lot with the highways, and once I-55 came down this way, most of the growth, the vast majority of commercial and residential, has been to the west. And if you look, I mean, at least symbolically, there's a big river wall that protects us, a big flood wall. And by the 1960s, the city not only has moved away from the river, we don't even look at the river anymore. But in the last 10, 15, 20 years, we are now at that stage of development where we're coming back to the river, and a lot of the gentrification, a lot of the rehabilitation of historic properties. The university's new performing arts center is the old seminary, which is there at the river. Cape seems to be finding its way back to the river, and part of our revitalization is based on that back to the river movement.
Colin, can we trace our backslide back to the so-called Great Divorce between St. Louis City and County following the Civil War? I mean, you mentioned fragmentation a moment ago. We've got 90-plus municipalities in St. Louis County. Instead of having one big city, which would be about the fifth or sixth largest city in the country, we've got this fragmentation that you say is a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't trace the decline back to the 1870s, because the city was prospering from that point well into the era of the First World War. But I think it certainly made it much more difficult for the city to address its substantial problems, because you do have under Missouri law the ability of these small, what began as subdivisions, to incorporate and zone and to do so in such a way that they poach the central city of its basic resources. There have been innumerable attempts, sort of one a generation, to try and stitch the city and the county back together again. The one that I like most from a historical point of view, although it's the most fanciful, was a map drawn in the 1960s, which remapped all the municipalities in the area as sort of pie slices that started at the riverfront and radiated out into what is now what is St. Louis County, so that everybody had a responsibility for governing a little bit of the old industrial riverfront, a little bit of the older neighborhood, a little bit of the inner suburbs, and a little bit of the outer suburbs. And, you know, it's most interesting just as a thought exercise to think how those governments would make decisions differently.
You know, you're probably aware of the fact that the mayor of St. Louis is seeking an unprecedented fourth term today, by the way, is interested in having the city re-enter St. Louis County as just another one of those municipalities. Does that idea ring your bell?
Well, I mean, I think it would it might accomplish a little bit. I mean, I think it would certainly help on schooling, on some of the other sort of basic services. But the larger problem is that the city needs to be governed as a metropolitan area and not as a collection of corporate fragments. And so what a city like St. Louis does, for example, for its sewers, they have a metropolitan sewer district because you can't have a sewer sort of stopping and starting at every municipal line. I think they need to do the same thing for zoning and for economic development, and that would make a big difference.
And there is some talk of doing that. I mean, there are talking about finding ways like that to cooperate without having to have a full-scale merger, which probably would not pass a vote of the people, which would be required. You don't have that problem down there, Joe. I want to go to the phones, but you don't have the fragmentation problem that we're talking about.
Nope, not big enough to suffer from that.
All right, let's go to the phones. A number of people want to get into the discussion. Let's bring them in. We'll start with Jerry calling from O'Fallon. Jerry, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Good morning. Hey. This is a topic that kind of rang a bell with me because I'm reading a book right now called Detroit, An American Autopsy by Charlie LaDuff, talking about the essential implosion or collapse of Detroit, Michigan. And there's a lot of similarities as we were, again, an industrial town, a city, you know, we made the second largest automobile production in the 20th century for quite a while. And I think, you know, you're pointing out a lot of things that are it's kind of like a slow bust cycle. You know, we didn't have a big boom here, but as we watched the demographics change, as we watched the necessities of being in a central location have lost value over the last, especially the last decade or so, and I wish I could offer solutions, but I kind of think, yes, what we're seeing is another author in another book called Internal Colonies, where we have these places within cities that really are completely collapsed or close to it. And what most of us tend to do is, instead of trying to work as a community to bring everyone up to a certain standard, we just, you know, flee or go somewhere else, and it's become someone else's problem. And I guess until we can reverse that mindset or the actions that requires, we're going to kind of follow the same track.
Thanks, Jerry. Colin, that pretty much fits your narrative, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that's a very good description. I mean, the issue is not the economic vitality of the region or the metro area so much as it is the stark inequality within it, which is abetted by the sort of the history of public policies that I've described. I mean, Detroit, you know, is often, as the caller said, the poster child of this, but St. Louis actually has a starker central city decline over the second half of the 20th century than does Detroit. It loses over 40%, rather over 60% of its central city population between 1950 and 2010.
And leaving behind, and I hate to use words like this, but I guess that's the words people are using, an underclass, people who are literally trapped by their poverty.
Yeah, and if you think about the late 60s, and I was thinking in particular in 66 when Congress is debating what's going to become Lyndon Johnson's civil rights bill in 1968, But I mean, with the riots, ravaging most of the inner cities in the north, there's that real fragmentation of the civil rights movement, and largely because of those riots, that underclass has been trapped there. I mean, the activism that we associate with the 60s becomes much more focused in some regions, but much, much less effective.
Okay, let's go back to the phones and bring in Michael, who's calling from South St. Louis. Michael, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hey, I'd just like to say, as far as, first and foremost, our main highway is the river, which, thank God, has came up. But the Mike and Ike line, which runs all the way down the river, I'm sure to Cape, which you spoke of, they've been revitalizing it right at the casino area, just north of where the River Pier meets the Mississippi. And they've been doing a lot of work on the railroads. And I've been watching them. I've been watching the railroads. There's oil coming down there, all new kind of oil. They're running down through there. So I guess what I'm trying to get to saying is they are investing in the infrastructure. If you go down where Great Lakes Carbon Factory used to be, they've revitalized all those tracks, and I think that's a good idea. I really do. I mean, I really think that we should put a monorail down each highway to connect the communities. But that's another story. Anyway, I'd just like to say that they are investing in the railroad, and we need to invest in the river. That's our highway. That's why we're here. That's why this has been a major metropolitan for, it's been a long time. It was called Mount City before the Europeans landed here, you know.
Yeah. Michael, thank you so much for your call. Either of you gentlemen want to address the railroad situation? I think a lot of people overlook the railroads and the role they're playing and perhaps the increased role that they're playing almost before our very eyes, but many people don't seem to notice. Why don't you take that, Joel?
Well, I think, as the caller said, I mean, it's largely I can't say invisible, but it does get obscured, I think, how vital the railroad industry is. I think probably the most glaring problem is our lack of passenger service. And when you talk about decline and missed opportunities and what might have been, I mean, we had the greatest rail system in the world as late as the 1960s, but we have really squandered that, and our passenger service now is abysmal. And what might have been with high-speed rail in particular, talk about investing in infrastructure, I mean, that's a very tantalizing possibility.
Well, there is some effort underway between St. Louis and Chicago to develop a higher-speed rail system. It's going to take a little while. Will that be helpful to us, Colin?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the history of a region like St. Louis, I mean, you can see development and economic resources following that infrastructure. I mean, the first municipalities in St. Louis County were strung out along the rail lines that, and the, to a lesser degree, the streetcar lines that radiated out from the city. But with the automobile revolution, that suddenly dissipated and gives you a much more sort of chaotic and fragmented form of development. And I think, you know, with rising gasoline prices and the increased importance of public transit, we can, in a small part, start to stitch our urban centers back together. It's not a big innovation. It's really recapturing a form of metropolitan public transit that we had 100 years ago.
Well, they're talking about putting a trolley back in service here in St. Louis. I don't know if you're aware of that, but that's something that's under discussion right now. Let's go back to the phones and bring in Dan calling from St. Louis. Dan, go ahead. You're on the air with our friends, Professor Colin Gordon and Professor Joel Rhodes.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the thing that came to mind for me was I feel like the St. Louis metro area has missed some opportunities by not quickly copying some initiatives that have been successful in other cities and that could make St. Louis a more livable place, especially regarding transportation. I can give you a couple examples here. I mean, back in like 1992, California was already doing things to promote high occupancy vehicle use, you know, ridership, ride sharing, that sort of thing. They would monitor entrance ramps like at a bedroom community, and if that bedroom community had a high occupant, you know what I'm saying, if they had enough ride sharing going on, they would actually reward that community monetarily. Other cities, I mean, even like say a place like Nashville years ago, they've had high occupancy vehicle lanes, and we still don't have that. Another example is the large message boards that we see, you know, mostly along interstates, but also along Lindbergh. Those were up for 3 or 4 years and sat unused. You know, now they're being used properly where they can advise people about, you know, where traffic problems are and how to suggest alternate routes. One other example would be one of your people mentioned Detroit. Years ago, Detroit was using center turn lanes that are very common now here, but they were using that years before St. Louis went to that. And that's basically my comment. I think we've not been a place that has initiated those kinds of things. And where it's been done somewhere else, we really lag behind in copying what they do.
Dan, appreciate your call. I'm going to have to take a break, but I'll ask our guests to be chewing on that idea of missed opportunities during the next minute or so. We'll come back with Professors Colin Gordon and Joel Rhodes and continue our conversation after this break. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation about what makes a community tick. And we're thinking in terms of growth and economic vitality and opportunities and missed opportunities. And I want to get to that a second with our guests, Professor Colin Gordon of the University of Iowa and Professor Joel Rhodes of Southeast Missouri State. But before going to them, a reminder that both of these gentlemen will be participating in a program titled The Geography of Money. That's at 2 p.m. on Saturday at the Missouri History Museum. It is hosted by the museum and the Missouri Humanities Council. Okay, back to this notion of missed opportunities. I guess history can be written as much in terms of missed opportunities as those that were successfully seized. Colin Gordon, let me put that one to you first, this missed opportunities message that our caller just raised.
Well, I mean, I think the interesting thing about the caller's contribution is, you know, he quite rightly points out that there are a lot of little things you can do. I mean, you don't have to, you know, dramatically transform the city and you know, rip up all the roads and put in light rail or, you know, wipe away all the corporate lines. One of the real problems with the St. Louis metro region, and your caller pointed out with regard to traffic, is that the incentives are perverse, particularly in the suburbs, that there are incentives for each successive municipality to put up a new target, even if the one next door is only 2 years old. And then, you know, they get leapfrogged a year after the fact. That there are elements of the St. Louis tax code and the economic development programs that actually encourage the sort of most bizarre and destructive beggar thy neighbor kind of behavior. That would be relatively easy to turn around.
I want to come back to that, but let me go to Joel with regard to missed opportunities. How do you see that in your area?
Well, I think there have been several over the years, and again, you're talking about most of this in hindsight. I think there are folks that would look at some again smaller things, as Colin said, attracting a minor league baseball team or things of that nature that at the time. And for years they tried to get the casino here. So, I mean, the casino is the culmination of a lot of a struggle towards that. But again, I don't think it's macro. I think it's much, much smaller. But I actually had a question for Colin, too. I was thinking, are there other urban experiences that might be instructive to St. Louis? I mean, are there other models that St. Louis could follow?
It's a good question. It's a hard one to answer because the situations of American cities are, you know, relatively unique. I mean, I think there are elements that come from other experiences. I mean, I think Pittsburgh, for example, has undergone somewhat of a revitalization and diversification, partly because Pittsburgh sits in the middle of Allegheny County and it doesn't have that sort of fragmented that problem of fragmentation or at least direct competition between the county and the central city. We certainly see very different patterns of development in western and southwestern cities where the cities grow by annexation rather than by the creation of new sort of corporate fragments. And that's true in a setting like Miami or metropolitan Toronto. The pattern of development is very different.
You know, I want to go back to the tax issue, Colin, that you raised a moment ago, because an awful lot of communities, and certainly this one too, are relying very heavily on TIFs, tax increment financing, and tax abatement. Is this a technique that really works, or are we mortgaging the future by using these devices?
Well, TIF in Missouri, as in much of the rest of the country, is very poorly targeted and designed form of public policy. And I think that's especially so in Missouri. I mean, the problem with TIF as a strategy of economic development and tax abatement is it doesn't proceed from a sense of need. It doesn't identify an area of the region that needs help and send money that way. In fact, under TIF, it usually begin with a developer coming to a municipality and saying, hey, I want to put up a new mall. And so it tends to send the public subsidies where they're least needed. And in St. Louis, that's exaggerated by the fact that under Missouri law, you can capture not only the property taxes of new development, but also the sales taxes they generate. So everyone has an incentive to build that new big box retail out in the cornfields, even if its sole effect is to empty out somebody else's big box, you know, in the inner suburbs.
Yeah, a lot of people have pointed to Walmart historically for having really damaged many communities because of that very reason.
Right.
Go ahead, Joel.
Oh, I was going to say, one of the things that we have really tried to do at the university, we have a public history bachelor's degree here, and so one of the advocacy elements that we have is to try to educate people about historic preservation tax credits as a more viable form of economic development, and the tax credits that the state and the federal level have that promote the use of historic buildings and the rehabilitation of historic buildings. And again, it's very, very controversial, and the last few legislative sessions have tried to do away with it altogether. But it's something that we here in Cape Girardeau have really, really been pushing as a university community.
That's a good point because tax abatements and tax credits should be used for public purposes to accomplish something of long-term benefit to the community. If you look up it from the point of view of Walmart or Target, they look at a setting like Metropolitan St. Louis and they're going to say, well, yeah, we need 17 stores in this region. And they're going to have those 17 stores in the region if nobody throws money at them. But if as it happens, everybody throws money at them, they have the 17 stores and none of them pay any property taxes. And I fail to see the public benefit in that.
Yeah, at some point that's got to come back to be a haunting proposition. Let's return to the phones and bring in Tom calling from St. Louis. Tom, go ahead. You're on the air.
Gentlemen, I think really uninspired political leadership in St. Louis since 1875 is part of the problem we have here. And there was the comment about missed opportunities. Well, uninspired leadership births missed opportunities. And there is just I've lived in St. Louis for 40 years, and I've just always been underwhelmed by the political class here, especially the conversation about TIF underlines that.
Thanks,
but I would also say, you know, half glass full, half glass empty. There are advantages to living in a city that peaked in 1904.
Thank you for the call. Colin, do you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm no expert on sort of patterns of political leadership, but I think it is true that in a city like St. Louis or in a metropolitan area like St. Louis, you have, you know, one set of leaders of the smaller municipalities on the suburban fringe who are, you know, sort of short-sighted and inclined to be sort of selfish in their approach, in their zoning and economic development. They want what's best for their community, and they're not in a position to view what's best for the region as a whole. And then you have the leadership of the city itself, which is, you know, it's running a big American city is the sort of booby prize of American politics. You know, as the mayor of Rochester, once famously put it when he was congratulated on his reelection, he sort of said, "What are you congratulating me for? Look what I'm mayor of." You know, it's a wasteland. And, you know, municipal politicians are very constrained by the circumstances under which they operate and by the in particularly for central St. Louis, by the tax capacities that they can lay claim to.
We have an email from George and Kreve Coeur, whose comments fit right in here. Says one of your guests raised a point earlier about governance. I would take a step further and define it more as a problem of leadership. Civic Progress was criticized many years ago for setting the agenda for the St. Louis area. That's not nearly as powerful as it once was. But who is creating some sort of plan for the area today? And I live here. I'm not sure that I can point to a single individual. Colin, you've researched it for a long time. Do you have any ideas?
Well, I mean, I think to be fair, there are a lot of people in the St. Louis region who think about these problems constantly. I mean, I think of the work that's done at East West Gateway, the work that's done by sort of Focus St. Louis, and its various permutations of that organization. There are a number of civil rights organizations, equal housing groups that cross these boundaries. The problem is that most of those groups are relatively toothless when it comes to making real decisions about where the resources go.
How about you, Joel? What's the leadership issue down in the Cape Girardeau area?
Well, I think historically, if you look at the grand scope of the region, it has been from the private sector. I mean, it has generally not been at the municipal level or the county level. There have been private initiatives, and the most obvious for me is Lewis Houck. I mean, much of the events that drove the region's development, the railroads, the university, the Little River Drainage District, Houck's fingerprints are all over that. So there's been that historically, and I think today the same is true. I can think of several individuals here in Cape that really have the resources, but also have the vision. Earl Norman, which probably won't mean a whole lot in St. Louis, is a local entrepreneur who, as Colin said, spends a lot of time thinking not only where Cape is, but where it can be.
I think a comment from Ed calling from the city of St. Louis will fit right in here. Ed, go ahead. Thanks for waiting.
I remember years ago when the author was on your show, and I'm sitting here with his book right in front of me because I bought his book, and it is a big picture of a decaying street. And I remember that, and I bought that book. And I just recently, because I just read A People's History of Baseball, because I believe this is a great baseball town. And what that says, it's about power. And I can just see the power is coming back to St. Louis. The moneyed interest is coming back to St. Louis. I can see it. And it's about power. And I can see it. And I think I got a kid who lives in St. Louis, and I'm glad they live here because I think St. Louis is coming back because the moneyed interest is deciding we're coming back to St. Louis.
Hey, just for clarification, what is it you are seeing specifically?
Well, I worked for the railroad, the Missouri Pacific Railroad and the Union Pacific Railroad for 16 years, and I ride my bicycle now over the railroads are coming in here big time, and there's a lot of things that I see on my bicycle. You cannot see where the railroads go. They hide things. They're coming in big time, and that is big money. These are the people who really have influence in this country, and when they decide this town's going to make it, they're going to make it. And what we have, really, we have water, and we have food. And there are so many cities like Phoenix. They're going to run out of water. We're going to be sending them water. Because one thing a city people need is water. Mark Twain said that. Whiskey is for sipping. Water is for fighting over.
Okay, well, thanks for your call. I'm not sure we had a whole lot of water to send anybody last summer, but that's another story. It didn't help the river traffic very much either. Do either of you gentlemen want to respond to the return of power and moneyed interests?
It struck me about the civic role of baseball because I was discussing urban rioting several years ago. Some of my research and writing interests are on that, and somebody asked why Kansas City had a riot in 1968, but St. Louis was relatively spared from the collective violence of the Vietnam era. And there's one school of thought is that St. Louis had baseball, and that baseball largely captured the imagination of the city and gave people something perhaps to do that they didn't have in Kansas City. I don't know that that's exactly historically the case, but I thought that was an interesting take on the role of baseball to solve civic problems.
Colin?
I think going back to the caller's point about possibilities for a sort of rebound, I mean, I think one thing that a city like St. Louis has going for it is the sort of assets that the caller described, but also the fact that having gone through a period of really fairly dramatic decline, that both industrial and residential land are relatively cheap in central St. Louis. And at a certain point, one would hope and one would expect that the market would step in and things would get cheap enough, assuming that there's sort of basic infrastructure support, that the rebound would come naturally via market forces.
Yeah. Well, the same kind of assets apply right across the river in East St. Louis, and Lord knows that it has its problems. But perhaps Mary, who's joining us from St. Louis, has an idea or can give us some ideas or inspire some that can help us all. Mary, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Oh, my. I can't do that. I was actually hoping the guests could tell me if there are any encouraging signs in the area on the horizon, and what an ordinary citizen, what efforts, any grassroots things we can do to get the collection of communities to work together rather than competing against each other. And the mention of the Walmarts being built all over with TIF money only to drain money and people from other Walmarts is one of the best spoken thoughts I've heard in a while, and sad, but I'm just hoping that the guests have something encouraging or something they can tell us to get more involved and make a difference.
We have 2 minutes left. Joel, let me start with you and take up to a minute to respond, if you would, then we'll go to Colin.
Sounds good. I think that historic preservation is one of the keys to this, to revitalization and economic development, because on one hand, not only are you shifting the focus away from those big box stores and putting it back into the vital heart of some of these smaller communities, but also it's giving people that authentic sense of place that I think we certainly are lacking in the 21st century. So I would encourage people to get involved in some of the older neighborhoods, some of the historic buildings, and start to think about creative ways to reuse that historic fabric.
Thank you, Joel. And Colin, to you, about a minute.
I would say schools. I think schools are something that that naturally draw people into politics at the local level. They have a deep investment in the quality of schools. And schools are the big losers when we lose tax capacity as a result of decline or give it up as a result of perverse economic development deals. So, I think people can get involved in politics via school boards and via school politics. And I wish schools themselves and the local school boards would be more vocal as a sort of cross-cutting force against some of these sort of destructive and fragmentary tendencies.
And, of course, if the schools are not up to standard, it not only will drive people away, it will prevent people from coming in, which is a phenomenon that we've had to deal with here in St. Louis. Professor Joel Rhodes of Southeast Missouri State University, thank you so much for being with us. It's a pleasure talking to you. Professor Colin Gordon, University of Iowa, thank you. And you two fellows will meet face-to-face for the first time on Saturday in the program titled The Geography of Money. That's at 2 p.m. Saturday at the Missouri History Museum, hosted by the museum and the Missouri Humanities Council. I appreciate both of you being with us. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at the results of the local elections taking place today, and then we'll talk to Caroline Kennedy about her new book of poems for young people. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.